Hello, Beezer. Welcome to Origins.
Hello,
I'm
Nick. Thank
Nick,
you for having me.
your other co-host. We tried to record this intro once. It didn't work out. We also already did the interview with Missy. Let's just be honest about what's actually happening here in the creation of this podcast. So this is now us a week later, re-recording this. But great episode with Missy. She's in, how would you describe Missy?
She is a bit of an outsourced CIO, although she doesn't use that title explicitly. But it sounds like, from what I understand, she does is she helps family offices or potentially endowments or foundations that do not have an in-house team think through what they want to invest in, what their strategy is, and then help them go find investments. So it is essentially an outsourced CIO and team.
Yep. And she's got a varied background. She was a biochemistry major in college. I was looking at that and that was a really interesting discussion and a much I'm going to stop. I feel like I was listening to podcasts and I used the word aperture way too frequently. So I'm going to try to stop using that. She has a broad view into various different markets and asset classes, and I thought that was really interesting to get her perspective on that outside of just venture.
Yes, I appreciate understanding when someone can invest in absolutely anything from what she was explaining, why and how venture fits and why and how it doesn't, because turns out a lot of times it doesn't, which I think in our world feels odd to know, but it's very true.
Right. Actually, you know what's funny about that? Well, one, what was interesting is that all of her clients and families are invested in venture. But I was just thinking, we raise these little community funds alongside our main funds for Notation historically. And it's for not really family, but friends of the firm, founders, other operators in the community. And it's always made me slightly uncomfortable to manage like money. In many cases, they're like really close friends. And so my disclaimer when we've done these is this is a terrible investment. You're not going to see your money for 10 years. It's highly illiquid, it's highly risky, and there's probably way better ways to invest your money than with us. And if you're still comfortable with all of that, then you can write a very small check that won't make me uncomfortable managing your money. So yeah, I guess people still invest in venture though.
And what I liked about having Missy come on after Beth was that we did the Series A perspective and then circled back to how an LP is looking at the market today and just trying to round out, given this is a bit of a rationalizing market. I'm not sure if that's the best word. It's sort of like you don't want to use the word aperture. I don't want to say rationalize every day, but it does feel like the world is coming back to a little bit of gravity. So continuing to get different touch points on what people are seeing in it, I appreciate.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is something that people just feel like they need to say, but they're both actively investing. Most there's actually it's very difficult for me to even think. I'm sure you see it more in LP land. Like VCs are investing, maybe slightly slower pace, but they're making investments. I don't know a single VC that's like, yeah, we're sitting this out until inflation goes down to 2% or whatever.
No, because the business model dictates that one keeps investing. But I would say the Q2 numbers are out. Both PitchBook and Carta have made some announcements, and the Venture Monitor, and it's definitely lower activity rates right at the growth
Yeah.
stages and things like that. So I think it the data says that it's slower. Series A is slower. So the conversation we had with Beth, folks are still taking their time. I don't think they're not investing. What still seems to be, I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but more steady state-ish is the pre-seed
Yeah.
and seed. Although it
Yeah.
does feel like angels are slower to deploy given some of the numbers, but I don't know how to parse all that information because the definition of who counts as an angel, some people are angels with rolling funds and other ways is a bit trickier. And I
Yeah.
would say the other wild card is if you take things like AI out, how does that shift everything? And I don't have an answer, but we're tracking that.
Yeah, it's one thing that Missy said that stuck with me was that when she looks at other asset classes, in theory, other asset classes would be more attractive today. But many of those asset classes have also not repriced, maybe treasuries aside. And so I think in using that sort of drilling into venture, you'd think that this would be the best time to invest. You should be super aggressive, but only if things reprice, and they probably haven't really, really repriced, which is why you're now seeing a slower pace. But if they did like just talking from our perspective, if things did meaningfully reprice, I would suspect we would be much more aggressive. Our pace would increase. But we haven't seen maybe small repricings here and there, but not super meaningful. Maybe later stages have been more repriced.
Yes, because the public markets have repriced. I know we've got some public stock markets. There's all sorts of reports about the first half of the year, but in general, the repricing of the SaaS stocks has occurred. And outside of the except of the very strong performers in NVIDIA and things like that, there's a lot more repricing going on.
Yeah. I think the big question for early stage venture now, like in looking back a few years forward, looking back, is does early stage venture ever reprice? Particularly in the last quarter, I'm starting to see things reprice, like not significantly, but pretty consistently across the board. But I'm 50-50. Like 3 years from now, if we look back, will there have been this moment where things finally are like, okay, seed is going from a $10 or $15 million valuation to a five or a six? Or if just that never happens. And I don't know. I convince myself on both sides of the coin, but we'll see.
Well, we will see indeed. I think the next 6 months will be very informative.
Okay. This was a much better intro. Let's get to Missy. Missy, thank you so much for having us. You have a wider aperture around investing than a lot of the folks that we've had on Origin. So I'm very excited to dig in. Missy and Beezer meeting for the first time. It's a special moment for me. So why don't we jump in? Missy, could you give us a little bit on your background and the type of investing that you do? I don't even really know where to start. We've known each other for years. But I don't even know really how to describe it. So I'm excited to hear you describe it.
It's hard to describe. It's almost easier to describe what I'm not than what I am, but I'll give it a try. So technically I am a fee only, you're OCIO, my firm is a fee only non-discretionary investment advisor, which basically tells you nothing. But what I do is help my clients achieve their financial goals in their commingled entities over the very long term. I am a absolute generalist, and I will go anywhere and dig into anything that I feel is likely to be additive in the pursuit of them achieving their specific goals. And because of the lack of bandwidth, basically me, my clients have to have pretty similar long-term goals, even though the portfolios are not commingled at all. Each entity's portfolio is its own thing. And I came to this, and just, you know me, I'm a born and bred New Yorker, so just interrupt me if I'm going somewhere that isn't good or you have a question.
Sounds
I
good.
Came to this in a really unusual way because I am like the most general of generalists, but I came to this from I came into the investment business from something super specific. So I studied, I love chemistry. I studied chemical engineering in college, didn't realize that was designing distillation columns in Texas, which wasn't going to happen. So I became a biochemistry major, which I loved, but I'd always been practical and it wasn't very practical. So I went to work in the labs at Merck. And thinking that, okay, if you do science in industry, it's going to be different, but good science is good science. And poking cells to look at action potentials in a, you know, a RF frequency shielded room day in and day out was just not going to happen. So I did literally a job search, like what kind of job would be fun? And I learned there were people who were actually paid to research companies that create drugs. And I said, oh, I could be an assistant to someone who does that. I can do spreadsheets. I did punch cards. That's how old I am.
Mm-hmm.
I can do spreadsheets. I can do numbers. I was a mathlete, for heaven's sake. I can do any of that stuff. And I wrote 300 cold letters on a typewriter and learned to drive because I was interested at the time in LA, and landed in a training program at the Capital Group. And I finished that program. That program was unusual because if they like, I don't know how it runs now, but for a very long period of time, if they liked you, they hired you as though you had an MBA. And I loved school. I got school. I didn't really want to go back to school. So that was really attractive. So I was hired, interestingly enough, if you know your stock market history, as a chemical industry analyst out of that program in September of 1987, and then subsequently added the healthcare industry, and those were my two industries. Everyone at Capital manages money. So you can already see my aperture grew wider. And then really for family reasons, when I was thinking about working on starting my family, I realized there was an issue with trying to do everything that I was doing in the context that I was doing them. And my mother-in-law was adopted into the family that founded Carnation. They had long-term generation skipping tax-exempt trusts that were poorly managed by bank trust departments. They were interested in doing better and were open-minded and welcomed me into that process. So that began my journey of becoming a generalist, understanding all of the different aspects that go into managing those types of assets well, and then pursuing areas of interest and, you know, and opportunity as they arose. So that's what has progressed to be what I am now. I'm not a family office, but I work with family offices. So
would you say then, can you share and sort of for folks on the who are listening who are probably the LP world is very opaque and it's hard to understand,
yes.
even for the best of us. So would you say your clients tend to be family offices or more endowments and foundations, or it's a whole
no.
mix and it
it's
doesn't
all
matter?
Taxable. It's all taxable. It's all family, people, human money to date. That doesn't mean that I would never advise a family foundation. But there are also a lot of people who do that really well and a lot of infrastructure that exists already. What I've found, and I think my clients would say, is that where there's a gap is with families that really don't have the means to have a full out dedicated family office of their own. They can do the administration, either hire it out or do it internally. But the investment work and intellectual coordination and thinking about all of the different pieces together and making sure as best as possible that things make sense in the complicated context of trusts and taxpaying humans, they want to hire out the investment piece. And that's really where, because that doesn't exist very well in the names that you think about today.
Gotcha. So is it accurate to say if I was a family office with my $2, you would help, you'd basically be my outsource investment team and say with your $2, you should have a diversity of assets, or no, go long, it's all Bitcoin, or whatever it is that works for me and my goals. And then you'd be like, and within that sect, maybe given this podcast, we'll assume venture plays a role.
Yes.
And then I'll go find Nick for you, like soup to nuts, like you do all that.
Exactly. And we'd start with really detailed conversations around what you're trying to do with those assets, what your risk tolerance is, when you need them, or when you want to have them accessible to you. And, you know, so what can you tolerate and what's right for you?
Beezer and I, we were talking about this a little bit earlier. There's a meme in venture circles that, you know, I forget what exactly the meme is or the language.
One family office, you know one family office.
Correct. And it's one of the reasons that I think we've always struggled, or I even haven't really spent that much time trying to navigate family office world. I still don't feel like I have any sense of it outside of maybe you, Missy. and even then, I'm still learning. And so I think it'd be helpful just to understand why that is. Like, and I think I have a sense, you know, every family is different, has different goals. And then I think it'd be helpful to understand from your perspective when you are working with a new family or with an existing family, just how diverse the sort of goals and investments and portfolios are. And like, does every family you work with have venture, do some have it, some not? And I'm just curious if you could maybe dig into that a little bit.
So in reverse order, because I've been in the position of needing to carefully curate who I work for whom I work, everybody has reasonably similar long-term return goals and risk tolerances, because I think I can't functionally address everything. I try to be really realistic about what I can do and what I can't. So presently, that doesn't mean this is forever, but presently, yes, there's venture in all of the portfolios. One of the things that is different about what I do is it's all commingled entities for families that either, because the underlying investors are long-term trusts that, you know, are going to be around for another 60 or 70 years, or because we do work with the investors to say, this is a long-term vehicle. This is not money that you can take out. They do have a long-term view. So I can't do that breadth, but family offices do have that breadth, broadly speaking. They are incredibly heterogeneous. And I would suggest to you, Nick, just like me, that the family offices that are going to be a good fit for a firm like yours, they'll find you.
I'm sorry. Maybe dig into that a little bit.
Can I jump on this and ask the politically incorrect question, which is, it feels a bit, and I get this all the time, it feels a bit like LPs don't want to be found. And that's because you know, if there's a school, you know, there's an endowment. So it's whether or not they're making venture is a different question, but you can kind of figure that path out. And it feels like I get this critique a lot from folks that LPs are hard to find. We're opaque. We don't really share what we're doing. And then people have an even harder time with the family offices. But you're saying, like, then don't worry about it, essentially, because if you can't find them, they probably aren't interested in venture. So why spend the time? Is that a nice way of saying it?
Or interested in you.
Yeah. Or interested in you.
Yeah.
Yes. I think, and there are so many that I think it would be a huge time sink to try to attack the market. Now there are, I've never been to one, but there are conferences where people do pay to go. And so perhaps that could be a way to leverage. And there are some that are very well respected, but yeah,
is there an example?
I've never been to one, so okay. I'm not comfortable, but there are some that I know people I respect. But I guess I would also turn it around and say, why? Like, what is missing from your LP base that you wish you had more family office connections?
For me personally?
Yes.
Nothing today. So it's not a top priority, but I think there's a lot of emerging managers that are, you know, let's say take Notation a couple funds ago, that are trying to navigate capital landscape for the first time. And like Beezer said, there's a few LPs that sort of make themselves available and market themselves. So those are understood. And then there are identifiable institutions, endowments, and others. And but a lot of those folks are not investing in first-time, second-time funds. So I think the interest in family, navigating family offices broadly is it's just there's a lot of capital. If you aggregate all the family offices, it's a gigantic amount of money. And it's seemingly this pool of capital that's highly opaque and like maybe available for a lot of emerging managers, and it's difficult to find. But maybe your point is that they'll find you if they're really interested.
I'll double into that because a lot of times, and Missy, feel free to tell me that I'm totally wrong. Before people come to institutionalize and get the $15, $20, $25 million plus endowment foundation check, it's a friends and family high net worth kind of fundraise, like essentially a notations first raise, right?
Yeah, totally.
And then high net worths have family offices. So potentially erroneously, but I think people clump the two to some level and say, I need to find family offices because they're going to help me get off the ground for my first couple of funds.
That's right.
Is there... And you're like, no, that is just blow that myth up.
No, I think I believe that that is true. But speaking candidly and directly, I mean, I think part of the issue is that venture got looked to be quite easy, and so the number of emerging managers in recent years just exploded, and not some with really clear rationale and reason and why it's the right time, and others without that. And I think there's both a supply and a demand. I think it would probably be easier for emerging managers to navigate this a bit if there weren't so many of them. And to your point about not wanting to be found, I'm, for better or for worse, I'm really a really good fast triager. But the volume of cold reach outs is just insane. I can't imagine, Beezer, what your life is like. even for me, like, how in the world did you find me? And
well, Missy, after this podcast, it's going to change.
I was going to say, get ready. Missy.
I'm always looking for things that are, I always have like a certain theses or people whose background seem like a really great fit. And I really like to have a wide aperture, but it's really hard. I think I almost feel like I don't know if advice or whatever, but just, and this isn't really so much as an LP as just someone who's been in this world for a long time, is for an emerging manager, make sure you're really clear on why your fund has to exist and why you're the right person to lead it, and then be really intentional about who's going to get it, right? So I think that in the world of the internet, I mean, I wrote those 300 cold letters. There was no internet. There's a lot. I think that curating your reach outs and doing it thoughtfully, using LinkedIn like as a warrior to find some sort of warm connection, or at least research the person a little bit and say, I purposefully don't have my details blocked, any of it. I feel like that work would be a lot more productive for emerging managers than the quantity. I feel like a lot of the reach outs are quantity. It's how many, it's a metric that can be measured, right? It's the same thing in a lot of businesses. It's like, how many reach outs have you made? Have you hit your quota? How many of those turned into calls? But that really, that's measurable. And research and connection is not measurable, but I think it's more effective. I don't know if this is helpful at all, but that's what I feel. If I were an emerging manager, if I were, a young person who feels like I have an idea, I'm the right person, I have the right background to do it, I would scour my network for people who would actually get it, and then use that as the base and ask them for introductions if we resonate with each other. That's what I do with managers. That's how, when I get interested in an area, like I will do cold reach outs, but absolutely. But I tend to look at the network of investors I already respect and say who's also doing distressed debt or real estate or whatever the area is, who's doing that, and have it ask for a chat.
What's your perspective on venture and the, at a macro micro level, the role it can play in a portfolio? Like, are you a net buyer, or are we like time to wait and see if it falls more?
So it would be helpful to say why. So I didn't do a lot of venture. Venture is really fun. But for the early parts, I did not do a lot of venture because it's a really, I don't need to tell you guys, it's a really, really hard way to make money. And it's an exceptionally hard way to make money as an LP. And it's an exceptionally, exceptionally hard way to make money as a small LP trying to network and get into the best opportunities. So I didn't do it for a really long time, or not very much. I did a little bit, but not very much. I came to it kind of when Nick and I are close to around the time in the mid-teens, largely because the flood of capital after the financial crisis just competed away all of the ways to make money. And within venture, for me, the most obvious way to do well is to be involved in companies or have exposure to companies that are solving real problems, do it very early in their lives, and own enough of them on a look-through basis so that if they are big winners in 7, 10, 15 years, let's be realistic, right? I know fund lives are 10, but no funds ever end in 10 years, that it will move the needle, right? So that's why I do venture. And that hasn't changed, nor have the other opportunities repriced meaningfully. So to me, I don't view it in the same way as other people. I don't have a bucket to fill. I just feel like it is, you know, the best opportunity. I think today, I've done very little, not none, but I've done very little later stage venture. And what I've done is really different. It's really off the beaten track of what most people have done. I would say today, if anything, I'm somewhat more interested. I think it's really hard though I think it's really hard to navigate buying at the right prices, the right companies, when too much capital has been raised at too high valuations. I think that that's a very difficult thing to navigate. And I think most people who really know that space have legacy portfolios that are really problematic. But that is something, if anything, I think there are additional areas of venture that I'm interested in. I don't know, did that answer your question?
I'm curious. I'd be curious what parts of venture are piquing your interest. But two, I'm curious, there's a lot of LPs that are sort of newer. I don't mean to just describe you as new, but you know, have not been investing for decades in the venture market. And we meet a lot of family offices that are sort of navigating, or we've met a bunch in the last couple of years. You seemed to get to like the heart of the network very quickly. And have a very good judge of the people in the venture network. So I'm mostly just curious how you did that when you were starting, you know, let's call it 2015. And then two, I'm curious, where you're spending most of your time in venture today and what's most interesting to you.
I don't know. It's just me. Like, so what I said, like, I do the work. I don't know. I think a lot of investing is art, right? I think we want it to be, and big institutions kind of need it to be science and long investment memos and checklist and everything, but I think a lot of it is I got to the heart of what I wanted to get to, right? I was very clear on why I wanted to do venture and the kinds of investors I wanted to connect with. It was the same thing for the tail risk hedge. I did, you know, I just, that's...
All right, explain to us what this tail risk hedge thing is.
What is a tail risk hedge and why?
Explain
and also,
to us what this is.
Please also explain this, and then also explain, because I think the context of my question is, I think a lot of folks doing venture don't always understand that folks like you are choosing amongst a apparently huge range. And how does the venture return profile risk reward equate to something like tail risk hedge?
Oh,
and why
totally
is that better? But it's totally different. But like, I feel like, and I'm guilty of this too. Like, we're like, oh, it's venture. Like, obviously venture is awesome. Why would we not do venture? Venture, venture, venture. But apparently the answer is no, there are other options. So if you could sort of say like, do you know what I mean? I think it would be helpful.
Okay, so I'll try. There are lots of ways to tail risk hedge, but the way I think about it is we've had the or at most U-shaped recoveries from financial markets crises for a long time. And what happens if we have an L, right? What happens if because of inflation, because of whatever, the Fed doesn't print their way out, the monetary authorities don't print their way out of it? I want my clients not only to be able to meet their obligations to the funds that they've committed to, but also actually be able to be opportunistic, because a lot of people don't prepare. So if you are prepared, there are even more opportunities. So people tail risk hedge in different ways. I spent a lot of time getting to know hedge funds that really are volatility investors, not tail risk. So they do very well when the stock market gets very volatile, and not volatile because the Wall Street Journal says it's volatile, mathematically volatile, which, believe it or not, even last year, it actually wasn't mathematically volatile. What I'm looking for very specifically is, or what I was looking for and found, it's quite expensive. It is absolutely positively not insurance, but the best way to think about it at a very rough level is that you're willing to spend some money on margin to have exposure to things that if the market goes down 20% quickly, will make you extraordinary returns. I mean, making venture look like nothing because of the leverage.
Shocker. How is that possible?
But the vast majority of the time, just like hopefully your homeowners or car insurance, the vast majority of the time, it's just money out the door. Most of the time, I've been able to construct portfolios that I thought were diversified enough and there weren't risks in the world that made me say that spending that money was necessarily productive. But at the start of, you know, as we got closer to 2022, I just felt a lot more uncomfortable about the confluence of circumstances. And like, so in that case, which is similar to venture, someone who's in the, it's not the family office space. They really are an RIA. They serve clients like mine. And they happened to have a contact at a firm that I had wanted to get to, and I had cold reached out and I got an introduction. And like, so I had this in the back of my mind for years. And then I just, when I had the opportunity to get the connection, I took it and then did all my homework and then only acted on it when it felt right. So I do a lot of that, and it's the same sort of thing in venture. I was very fortunate to have someone way above my pay grade intellectually and everything in this space at an institution be kind enough to spend some time with me and make introductions for me. I mean, one of the good things about being so small in this world, but doing my homework, is that I'm not a threat to anybody. Like, they're not going to lose their spot, or I'm not going to displace them, or I'm a pimple on an elephant in terms of capacity right now, relative to an endowment. I did the same thing in venture, so hopefully that gives a little more context of how I'll meet people. When, and that this goes to, because you asked about that. So I'd done a lot of distressed debt. And then when the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s happened, you know, it was a much smaller world then, but I just called my GP, my favorite GP. And I said, are you looking at this? What are you doing? And he said, not so much. It takes special, but let me introduce you. So that's what I do.
Stop me if I'm over extrapolating, but the question I get frequently is like, what are LPs making of this market? And what I'm hearing, besides the fact that like, oh my goodness, is the world so much more complex financially than half the time I'm aware of? It feels like the metaverse is out there and you're like, oh, who knew? LPs are looking at this market and saying there's numerous ways I can play it because we might not be done with the rocky times. And there's a role for venture in my portfolio, but I'm going to consider a potentially a wider aperture because, to your point, if I can get a 5% 5% return on a very stable product, it's not going to necessarily be the same return profile as something else with higher risk, but it's stable and that compounds. And like, so the aperture is wider. Does that, I don't want to over extrapolate, but does that feel like a decent trend line?
I think that you're absolutely right, but I would say, in my view, pricing and valuations in other areas have not, the areas that actually would be competitive with venture, so whether that's buyouts, distressed debt, I've been looking for a real estate correction for years.
It might be coming, just wait.
It might be coming. So actually a manager, a very small, below the radar manager, who is just the most disciplined investor. Sorry, Nick, you're number two, but the most disciplined investor last year raised the first fund that he raised in like 20 years, literally, and committed to that. Yeah.
Investing in what? In what?
Small shopping centers that
or what,
are
really, what has he not been investing in for
20 years? Exactly. So that was a long that was investment
bad joke.
Cycle.
Bad yeah. joke.
Well, no, I mean, he's done one-off investing, but he hasn't raised a fund. He hasn't thought there were enough opportunities to raise a fund, and he hasn't put any of the capital to work yet. So in any case, so Beezer, to your point, yes and slash but, I don't think that other areas have corrected enough to compete, and they have very different return profiles. So venture to me is, and this is also why I do venture. Venture has the greatest kind of fundamental risks, right? Because you're creating something that maybe if all works well, both in the financing side, execution, market development, everything has a huge return in a long period of time. So what, in an ideal world, I will balance that with is something like distressed debt, where you're basically going to own a company, but you're doing it through the debt, where maybe you only make 1.5 or 2 times, but you do it over 3 or 5 years. So there's a balance to it. Back in the day, I did regular old buyouts. I haven't done that in a long time, but maybe the pricing changes. So ideally, and if you look at the spreadsheets I keep for the entities, like I break it out into the private funds into these different buckets, and gosh, in an ideal world, they each have a different return profile, like how much I expect to make over what period of time, with venture by far being the piece of the portfolio that I think should have the largest multiple of money, which is what my clients really care about. But may or may not have the highest IRRs. I want it to be balanced, but I don't see that in the world today yet.
How much of Missy's, a lot of what you're talking about is sort of like, and we've talked about it on the podcast, I think with others, like kind of portfolio construction across asset classes or asset allocation. First, like, it sounds like you also have pretty strong like macro views. Like you have a view on the macro, and then one year you might express that one differently. The next year you might express that differently. And I'm curious, Beezer, for you too, like within venture LP world, do people have views on macro? Like, do you have a view on macro? Are they supposed to have a view on macro or not?
So the first thing I would say is the most nobody knows the future. So Nick, interestingly, I have to be macro aware, and I do have quote unquote a view, but I never invest against it. Like it drives me nuts. I think like the biggest mistakes that investors make are arrogance and thinking that you know more than you can possibly know. And I think that it can be incredibly confusing reading press today, reading journalism today, because so much of it is written as though this is what is going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen. I have no freaking clue what's going to happen. So I'm aware, but I don't trade on it. What I look at and what I do make decisions on is a range of possibilities, what is an internal sense of risk reward. Where I'll lean in, where I won't. But I actually don't make decisions based on that because I don't know the future. If I had a crystal ball, I would be one of those billionaires, right? A long time ago. I've been doing this long enough. I don't think it works that way. So it's more awareness. And I would say one of the things that's both my nature, but I also have to give a lot of credit to my training at Capital, and it wasn't so much training because they kind of just say go do it and you figure out how to do it, is just what is value? Value isn't necessarily, so I did, there's this very famous book called Graham and Dodd. There are ways that you can define it, but to me that has greatly broadened because you can't do Graham and Dodd on a venture company or a venture manager. But I do really look for value in the world and risk reward profiles that make sense. And that's how I use the macro, not to trade, not to find the next hot manager. I mean, every study that has ever been done that I'm aware of that looks at looks says that investors detract from results when they do that. And I don't have the arrogance to think that I can do that. I hope to get it roughly right. And I look for things that will help my clients do well and construct portfolios that, if I'm roughly right, will help them meet their goals.
Yeah, I mean, I would underscore all of that about is in an adventure specific world, it's just impossible to know. And so the worst thing to do is to try to time the market in venture. And history would show that if you are not a consistent player, I'm probably repeating what a bunch of folks know, and I'm sure Missy knows this. Like the power of power law in venture is not just that a couple of your companies will be the ones that return should you have the joy of having them. But it's also certain windows of time. So it's like the power law taken to the power law multiple. So if you miss that window of time of the exits, and PS, you therefore also have to exit. So it's not enough to IPO. You have to then distribute the shares. Just a shout out to LPs everywhere that didn't get their shares. Sorry, I'm gonna say all the politically incorrect things in our podcast. There's just gonna be a long window, right? And so, but you don't know when it's coming. Like nobody could see 2020 being this crazy year for all the money coming into venture. We thought we were all going to literally be dead, literally. So you just don't know. But you have to keep playing. And I've seen a bunch of studies that look at this and say, if you weren't in the venture in these couple of years, you basically blew all your returns. With that caveat, everybody that I've sat, that had the ability to sit at the table with that has this sort of a bigger portfolio than just venture is doing some level of this math, which is what's the state of the world? Are there some other categories where the risk reward was off because of a zero interest rate environment and has that shifted? Which doesn't mean to say they're not doing venture. It just might mean they're picking up tail risk hedge or something that just might have shifted and they can add that in or there's like rebalancing. I don't think there's gargantuan changes. And then there is some geopolitical stuff coming up, but we can leave that for another podcast because so much to unpack there.
Absolutely. So the only thing I would say a little bit differently, but it's more micro in every asset class to me, including venture, is I feel like that there is a herd mentality, and I really want managers in any area, including venture, to invest when there are specific opportunities that meet their criteria, whenever that is, and to not do it just because there are a lot of opportunities. So one of the things that I do differently is because I think there are times when one area or another is more attractive, I'm not afraid to have a lot more of the private portfolio focused on venture versus distressed debt or buyouts, if that's where I think the best opportunities are at that time. I'm not afraid of that at all. I think that that is a great value add to be able to do that and to not have like a board. Like, I'm the investor, then there's the CIO, and then there's the board. So you have to explain something in metrics that are measurable, and that's bucket filling. And I think on one of the other episodes, you talked about how everything's with a lag. So the numbers are just crap. I mean, talk about politically incorrect, but it's measurable. So that's how people operate. I don't have to operate that way. Thankfully, my clients have allowed me to lean in. So I do think that there are those things. What I will not re-up with a manager with is if they put money to work exceptionally quickly and without real reason. I mean, I don't mind if there's real reason, and I don't believe that it's got to be a deal a quarter, you know, spread out over this many quarters. I just feel like the best investors are thoughtfully opportunistic and thoughtfully contrarian, even in whatever that means in their specific world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you seeing that, Beezer? Like, are you seeing, Missy, it sounds like maybe there's one or two in your world, but are you seeing LPs like specifically slap the risk for managers that have deployed a lot of capital so quickly? Because it seems like maybe that hasn't actually happened. Mm-mm. Like, folks are talk about it, but
I think there's stuff going on underneath the surface. I think there is still always new money that comes in, it's entirely possible some LPs have rotated out of these funds, but there's new money that's come in, so it looks net like it's the same, but it might not actually be the same LP cap table. I would say, and this was a question I was emailing with Missy and you about before, which is I think there were a lot of funds who have not fundraising until next year in venture land. This could or could not be the same for buyout in other areas. I don't have the same numbers in front of me for that. But, and part of that is people are deploying slower because the venture market has just slowed down. And I think a non-zero part of that is also trying to stretch out some of this experience LPs were having of very fast fundraising and what that meant from all of this great pools of unfunded dollars out there. Like, the overhang means that LPs have a very large commitment that is still uncalled, which essentially shows up like a liability on your books. So for some LPs, that is not as attractive as it is for the GP. So I think there's some managing of that that's going on. It does beg the question in my mind, and I got this question yesterday from a fan of the Origins podcast, which was so lovely.
Amazing.
Who's excited that you're coming on, Missy.
What's the question?
The question was, what's going to happen in 2024? Because if all the GPs are waiting to raise thinking it'll be better, unless the macro becomes considerably better / a lot of distributions and people have rebalanced their books, is it really going to be better, or is it just going to be the same, different version of the same challenge of this year, which is a couple of funds will glom a lot of money and everybody else will still have a tough time? Made worse because everyone now is sort of at the end of their
by the way,
to invest.
Same question for startups.
Same
applies to companies. There's all these companies right now don't want to go raise right now. Push it off as long as possible. Maybe later this year, maybe early next. Going to be an extraordinary number of startups that raised in 2021, raising back half of this year and probably early half of next.
So you're talking about seed and A? Largely, Nick, or across the, or later?
I feel like between pre-seed and seed and seed and A, there's only so much you can delay a fundraise, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So you're sort of, I would guess it's probably less dramatic there, but A to B, B to C, C to okay. D. And then those companies come to market at the same time, which means the top probably similar to funds, right? I mean, you guys tell me if I'm wrong, similar to funds, like the top 5%, no problem, or maybe top 10% or whatever it is. And then the kind of second tier middle bucket probably have a really tough time. Some of them get it done, some of them don't. And then there's probably a lot of carnage. That would be my guess. So the contrarian view might be go raise now or sooner than you think, because unless you think you can wait till 2025, probably.
I always wonder whether it really is the top 10% that get funded, or if it's the top 10% of easy to understand fundable ideas, which right now are put AI in anything. And, you know,
sorry. I love that. No, this is an excellent, this is a really, I'm writing it down. Look, I have my pen. Like, this is an excellent question. My gut says you're right. Because there's a whole bunch of things. There's a whole bunch of funds you hear about later that have these very strong returns, and they're not necessarily names you've heard of every day.
Right.
But the people that get funded, it is somebody who can translate. I'm assuming this is somewhat true in the direct land too. They can translate their story. They have the metrics that are in the right pool of possible. And so they can fundraise, because fundraising means convincing someone else through whatever. If you can't communicate it via whatever communication style you use, it's going to be, I don't know how it works, right?
Yeah, there's probably a number of brave LPs and VCs in the next couple of years that don't fund the hype cycle stuff that will do extremely well.
Oh, you mean not doing everything AI right now at $1 billion valuation?
That's correct.
Nick, how are you feeling about AI right now?
That's correct. I was talking to somebody the other day, like my job, I don't know if this is similar to the way, I don't know. I'm curious to hear how you guys think about it, different than LPs think about it. But like, I've viewed my job as a pre-seed investor above all else. I need to be ideally before the hype cycle or after the hype cycle. I'm definitely not during the hype cycle. So we're not, for the most part, investing in anything with AI in the name. I kind of, my view is that the only way to actually compete and actually win and make a lot of money in very early stage investing is investing in markets that seem niche or overlooked that could become mainstream or hypey in the years to come. It's the only way to do it, because if you're investing in the hype cycle, I'm not just investing against other pre-seed firms. I'm investing against seed firms, Series A firms, all the way up to Sequoia. And that's not the way that we're going to win. So I'm curious from the LP perspective, like, I guess, yeah, similarly, like there's probably sector-specific funds that are very hypey right now in AI that are probably easy, or there's probably a lot of capital being attracted to those funds. Is that something that you'd like run away from because it's too hypey, or is that something you're running towards? I guess is my question. Or maybe I suspect it's the former for both of you, but I imagine there's clearly a lot of LPs running towards AI focused funds right now.
It's the same thing what I said about the when you look at Morningstar has actually done some really good work back in the day about this. When you look at how investors add or detract value from how the managers do, they almost always detract value because they always look what has just done well and then come into it, which is the analogy to the hype cycle that you're talking about. So I'm really bad during and even after hype cycles. I'm better before or between hype cycles for sure. Abizar, I don't know what you.
I love those reports that sort of show that if you get too involved as an investor, you muck things up. It's very comforting, actually.
Doesn't that go against everything that venture VCs pitch?
No, no, because as an LP, you're investing in a blind pool of capital. So you're like, oh, if I'm gonna basically, it reads to me like you cannot time the market as an LP.
Okay, got it. So the similar view would be like, you're a VC, you can help out, but you shouldn't be running and operating the company.
Well, and potentially there's a model out there that works in that, but that's very specific. What resonates for me is what you said, Nick, about, because people always ask me like, what's hot right now, or some version of that question. And I'm like, really, you want to be there before? And not me, the LP. Like, I'm listening for the GP who has a point of view on something. And I mean, I used to give this example. We invested in 2012-ish pre-notation in a fund that was very smart about data. And they were just looking at the power of data, because we had a thesis around data, and that resonated with us. And they have gone on to raise a series of funds. The first one was very enterprise-y software-y. The second one was a little bit more healthcare. The third is biotech. They've done climate. They've done deep tech. But the trend line is always data. So you can kind of, do you know what I mean? Like, I would never have predicted all these things would have happened. I just thought their point of view and the fact that we will have more data in the world and being smart on data was a very powerful, focused yet broad lens. And this is, so like, I don't know how to call AI. We now have, turns out we have a lot of it in the portfolio because people were ahead of it. Because if you follow, AI is not brand new today.
Oh, God, no. Right? I mean, you'd think that this was just invented, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. And it's just ChatGPT, basically.
But yes, but I do. I love what you say. This is a little bit of the Christian of early stage venture. You're so early in things, you have to catch a big wave versus being hyper specific and building a portfolio of individual bets, right?
I think though that it can't be, and I don't think you do this, Nick, but one of the things you said, I'd rephrase a little bit. It's not that you're trying to catch a wave. It's that you identify an opportunity that others don't see is as large as it is, and find a team that you feel is able to back it.
That's right. I less mean become hypey. I mean more become mainstream and well understood and recognized as large over time. Like if I think about every single one of the meaningful investments that have become very big for us have all been in markets that appeared niche, small, tiny TAMs that in the years to come became much larger markets and more mainstream and identifiable. And so for us, there's like, I don't want to be too financy about it, but like there is, I think the best like true early stage venture portfolio is 10, 25, whatever, 20, 25, 30 companies that have incredible optionality on markets becoming very large over time. Maybe Missy, you can correct me through the financial lens, but I think that's sort of it. And if it's already mainstream and Sequoia and Andreessen and others are looking at it, you're probably a little too late as a really early stage investor.
And then at least in my seat, I want a portfolio of those constructed somehow at my scale that don't overlap a lot.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I haven't had, if you look across everything, the ideas that multiple of my GPs have been in, their track record isn't fantastic.
Interesting. Because I feel like some, correct me if I'm a wrong beezer, but I feel like there's some LPs that like actually in some cases try to optimize for some overlap. Because they're like, then we'll like on a look-through basis own even more of potentially these good companies. What's the rationale behind that? Have you noticed any signal and actually there's like, the real outliers, there's only one and none of the others are in.
Well, I mean, think about some of your outliers. Maybe in the early stages, there's only a couple investors, but like Coinbase ended up being pretty, right? There was a lot of people that came into it because they ended up raising more capital. So it was opportunity sets. So I think there are, LPs are like snowflakes. Each one is different. To quote
not
the
as different
Christy
as the
of us.
Family offices, though. Or at least
although apparently, yeah. Apparently. But I would say there's definitely, I know some LPs who are like, hey, if I like X, why would I not want a lot of X? And then there are other folks who I know who want to have, do not want intersection, right? And they're like, no, they're fine if they do a seed fund that like, you know, credible, strong follow-on investors follow on it. And so they look for that overlap, but they want to make sure they're not overlapping too much at this stage because at seed, they want to make sure they're covering more, to your point, Missy, about optionality in the market. What are the odds that my three seed funds will all pick the two companies that end up exiting at $10 billion over the next 5 years? Like, that's pretty awesome if you can pick those managers, but the odds of that happening are pretty low statistically, right? Given how few companies IPO and IPO at magnitude. So some people prefer to cover different bases.
This has been really fun and very interesting. Anything we should end on?
I think managers should be find themselves and not chase. I guess that's the one thing that is implied in a lot of we've said, and I don't even know if you guys agree, but to me, the most important thing for any investor in any asset class, and definitely also in venture, is do you, and don't be driven by, okay, I can be, or be very careful about what you can raise money to do versus what you deeply believe you can do well.
Oh, amen to that, because yes, we see this wagging people all the time because there's a lot of money available for excellent investors for that. But yes, I think this is what people mean when the LP says stay in your lane. They basically mean stay with what makes you great. And if it's great as multiples.
I'll add my one last tidbit to that is I think earlier in my venture career, 10 years ago, I was fortunate to have a number of really good mentors. And in the early years, I tried to just copy like, oh, that works for that person. Like I'm going to take that. And I think I've done a better job in recent years, not to pat myself on the back, is just take these things more as inspiration, you know, and maybe a little bit of a guide, but less like I'm going to go try to carbon copy this amazing person because you can't do it like that amazing person, unfortunately. So, yeah, maybe. Anyway, my two cents is on that is you got to find your own way. But there are ways to take inspiration, I think, from other people in the market and other investors.
That's a good thing to end on. Let's stay
okay.
with that.
Okay. Positive. thank you so much. Thanks, Missy. This
thank
was
you,
so
Missy.
Much fun.
So fun.
Hope you guys have a great weekend. See you soon.
You too.